Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 25th of November, 2016, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. And we are delighted to say we will be joined by live video Skype link by David Scott with Northern Exposure. Well, the weather today has got most people, I think, smiling, a little bit of happiness drifting in because it's sunny, albeit a bit cold. And that seems to be the general report from across UK. And indeed, even north of the border.
Smiling.
Cold.
We're going to put a stop to the smiling anyway, because here we go. John Major. Well, he's worried about Brexit, of course. The PSYOP continues here. He's worried particularly about the 48%. They're really determined to try to stir up as much angst amongst the 48% as possible. And he says the tyranny of the majority has never applied in a democracy. And it should not apply in this particular democracy. He said, I hear the argument for the 48% who voted to stay should have no say in what happens. I find that very difficult to accept. He said some of the 52% voted because they wanted to leave Europe, or they didn't like the government, or they didn't like immigration, or they didn't like the fact that there was a Sunday in the week. So it's very difficult to know precisely where the balance of real opinion lies. And he said that the campaign itself was shameful. He said, we need to understand and say publicly that most immigration is a boost to our national well-being and not a drain on it. So there you go. He is wading in to the psychological operation. And David, I'm just going to bring you straight in here because I thought the word democracy meant that the majority had saw their will.
Well, this is the case. I asked Mr. Swinney a question regarding liberty, and he turned around and said, well, you get liberty if, and then he defined democracy. He said, no, that's not right. So often democracy is the very reverse of liberty. Democracy ultimately is two wolves and a sheep voting on what's for dinner. I'm amazed that this has only just dawned on Mr. Major. Maybe he's never lost before.
Well, that's possible, but Brian, this, I think, gives us a little bit of insight into the mindset of these people.
Yeah, I think this is fear, Mike. What we've got here are these people realising that they haven't got the control they thought they had over the views and opinions of the majority of people in UK. They got absolutely hammered on the Brexit vote, even though there was a little attempt to fiddle going on in the background. So now what are we seeing? We're seeing that they're fearful. They've got a start to put the slurs in, you know, the majority of people are not thinking the right way. We are the, what was the expression he used? He's saying we're the tyranny, that's the right word. So this is John Major, not one of our best prime ministers at any stage. And I don't know, is he harping back to his party days or something like that? He doesn't really know what's what. Fear, I think.
Yes, well, in the meantime, then, the threats from the continent continue. And this is Joseph Muscat, who's the Prime Minister of Malta. Malta takes the presidency of the EU in January. And so he was on the BBC this morning telling us how it really is. So he said that basically just forget about any idea of doing a really good deal. You're going to get hammered in terms of the money that you have to pay to get out. And he said, all of us have been pretty clear in our approach that we want a fair deal for the UK, but that kind of fair deal doesn't translate itself into a superior deal. I know there's absolutely no bluffing from the European side, at least in the council meetings I've attended. So he went on to say, this is really and truly our position. We're going to lose something with Britain leaving, is what he meant. We're going to lose something. But there will not be a situation when the UK has a better deal than it has today. So they, I suppose, are continuing to try to keep the pressure on to get us to stay in.
Well, they're absolutely keeping the pressure on to get us to stay in. And as we'll see in a minute, we're back on the subject of the fact that UK is being locked in by the day over the creation of the EU military. So just utter lies coming out of Westminster at the moment about the situation of Brexit. There is no Brexit, is there?
There is no Brexit, David.
Possibly not. Though we're not going to get a better deal. Well, presumably, or one would hope, that leaving this institution means we're no longer going to be the second largest contributor to it financially. So that's a better deal. We have the ability to make decisions and trade and operate in our own best interests. So we really don't need a deal from Europe. We would expect Europe to operate in their best interests and us to operate in ours. And because trade benefits both parties, we trade. Is it not as simple as that?
You would think so. But in the meantime, this, you wanted to highlight this in the Scotsman, Brexit, UK facing dreadful decade as living standards slip. And of course, Brexit being blamed for the Conservative Party's woeful economic policies, which merely a continuation of the Labour Party's woeful economic policies. And what they're basically saying is that, in 10 years' time, we will still have wages which are below the levels of 2006 or 2007, so just before the financial crash. But as I was pointing out yesterday, David, most of these economic measures that are being blamed on Brexit have been much longer trends.
Well, this is it. I mean, this is so full of errors. It's actually quite amusing. For a start, this is a team that have never forecast anything, right? But they can now forecast the effects of Brexit 10 years out. Oh, we know that, but we didn't see any of the last recessions coming. We didn't see the financial crash. We still don't know why it happened. But somehow now their forecasts are worth something. It's ridiculous. Now, the idea of we're comparing things with 2006, 2007, that was the largest bubble, the largest short-term unsustainable bubble that we've had since the 1920s, 30s?
Yeah.
Maybe ever. Maybe the South Sea bubble was, the Mississippi bubble was bigger, but it's been a long time. So that's now the benchmark, really? All we're seeing here is profound economic ignorance running the country.
Well, indeed. Okay, well, let's move on then. We're going to call this the fake news section because unfortunately, we're going to have to call RT out on it a little bit. Disneyland Paris, among landmarks considered for December the 1st, terror attacks, according to police sources. And there's a video clip on this report, which is some coverage from their news program, where they're really sort of giving this a bit of credibility that it probably doesn't deserve. So this is the French police with the usual rhetoric about, ISIS terrorists everywhere, can't turn around except you find another ISIS terrorist. They're going to blow up the Champs-Élysées. They're going to blow up Disneyland. They're going to blow up everything. They're saying, you know, basically the French, they're reporting unchallenged the French police's allegations, which are just speculative at best. The only, I suppose, thing you might say about this particular article is perhaps they're giving us a little bit of a hint on the front page by having the image of Disneyland in such a deep purple.
And Purple Revolution.
Since the Purple Revolution is ongoing, then perhaps they're giving us a clue. But really, we shouldn't be just pumping this kind of stuff out unchallenged.
No, this is true. And of course, you reminded me that I probably shouldn't say that maybe we should actually be looking at Disneyland as, is this really the sort of stuff that we want to be pumping into the heads of our young people? I'll leave you to think about that a bit more. Well, let's get into reality, and we'll come back to Russia today because they are talking about this in detail. So Tuesday, dagger pointed at the heart of NATO, US Secretary of State contender on the EU army. But Tuesday, the EU Parliament passed non-binding resolution calling for the creation of a defence union, and it justifies the move by the threats it says the bloc is facing. So these are the same sort of created threats that the fake news is pushing out everywhere. But we've got to say, yeah, Michael Fallon continues to lie that there isn't a drive for the EU military. Sorry, we could have put that a bit better there. But he's continuing to say, no, there is no drive for an EU military. But we've just had the passing of this resolution. Not only is there the drive for the EU military, they want the Treasury to go with it. And as we're seeing British warships being towed back into port because they're obviously not good enough, as we've got that situation, we're trying to ramp up the rhetoric for a war with Russia. So, David, just complete lies coming out of Westminster. I don't know how else we can put this across as news. You look at what they're saying, you look at what the truth is. These people are lying at every turn. The work is going ahead at rapid speed now to lock us into the EU via this military union. What's your thought on it?
Lying and lying to themselves also. It's amazing when you come across you come across news reports and you think, well, okay, I can dismiss that because it's simply some journalist trying to put forward a message of fear. Be afraid of the terrorists. Everything's very, very alarming. Be afraid. Vote for whoever will pretend to save you from your fear. But it actually permeates government policy. People are using real resources for this. I bumped into an ambulance man late one night in a McDonald's restaurant not far from here. He'd been up into the Highlands doing a rescue of a casualty from a mountainside who broke someone had broken the leg up a hill. So he's a very special sort of ambulance man that didn't, and I was asking him about his training, and he was saying that his roped access training had been suspended because he was being moved on to anti-terror training. There's no threat. There's no threat in Scotland, but police and ambulance forces are using real resources to run around lifting fake casualties and getting ready for a shootout with Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda is a pretty impressive organisation, because if they were going to do something north of the border, we've had Devon and Cornwall police saying that they were going to target holiday homes and complexes in Devon. And of course, UK Column has been able to look out the window and see large numbers of armed Devon and Cornwall police practising their anti-terrorist moves. So everybody's got to be very frightened. Let's bring Mr. Juncker in, because this is what he says. We need more security in Europe. We need it now. The idea that the Americans will eternally see to European security is not true. We have to do it ourselves. And this is why we need a new approach to the European Community of Defence, including a European army. But according to Theresa May and Michael Fallon, there is no drive for the European army. But then it gets interesting, because this man has also been speaking out, John Bolton. Sorry, it's a little bit faint there, but I'll read the text. If you want to rely on the EU with all the efficiency of the bureaucracy in Brussels, God help you, is all I can say. You have a lot of rhetoric about capabilities, but underneath it's all hollow. It's a hollow suit. You could end up provoking others, maybe Russia. And then when they find it's weak, you've left yourself in even graver danger. So this is John Bolton, former US ambassador to the UN. So he's describing the EU as a hollow suit and saying that ramping up the rhetoric, particularly against Russia, is dangerous. And he goes on to say this. He praised NATO as America's kind of international partnership, a classic politico-military alliance of nation states that never purported to assume sovereign functions and is as distant as is imaginable from the EU paradigm. A firm supporter of the military bloc, he even called for a global alliance to be formed. So what do you make of that, Mike?
So what's he saying? The European military, well, it's happening, but it's not going to be good enough. They're not really capable of it. So we need to just sort of move ahead from that before it's even really got established and create a global bloc instead.
Get all the power under one big umbrella. Yeah, interesting. Don't mess around with the EU. That's crumbling. What we need to do is draw every country into a worldwide military group, which, of course, will influence every nation state. David, with an eye on the clock, because we've got quite a lot to get through the news program, it's getting obvious, isn't it, that we have the drive for this collective new world government going on here.
Yes, Bolton's a very suspicious character anyway. And the first slide you put up there, I was amazed. I actually agreed with him. That's never happened before. Yes, the EU is an inefficient, pretendy organisation. But it could transform fast enough, you know, if it had an external threat, maybe. There are several being provided. Or if it had this sort of dynamic leadership that it's fortunately lacked until now. So I think it's partly you're seeing some of the globalists are concluding that the EU is not going to be the template they hoped it was for the rest of the world. But you're also seeing a desire to accelerate and remove nations and independence and with it any form of liberty.
Yeah, indeed. Well, you're making great efforts at the moment to wake up people in Scotland. And we've got the advert for your 30th of November event. Robert Green, I think you're hoping to be there, and a gentleman called John Smith.
Yes, Robert. Robert's going to be there unless something untoward happens. And you never quite know with the Scottish government. It's always possible. And he'll be talking about his ongoing fight for the Dohertys and Holly Craig and other similar cases. John Smith is speaking on the subject of commercial liens and how to use the law to fight back against corruption in high places, something he is very gallantly attempting to do in Scotland right now. So those will be both interesting talks, and I hope we get a good turnout. We've got a lovely venue. It's next to Glasgow Green. It's called The West, and I hope everyone can join us there. It's next Wednesday. We'll be there from about 6, but the talks start at 7 o'clock, 7 till 9.
Okay, excellent. Thank you for that. And I'm sorry that we can't join you, but we'll see what happens for future dates. Well, just bring in Melanie Shaw. We haven't mentioned Melanie Shaw for quite some time. Melanie is still in prison, Foston Hall. We have no full information about what she was charged with, whether she was convicted, whether she was on remand. She's still in prison. This is part of a letter that she sent to us some time ago. We put it up to emphasise that even though she's in prison, mainly in solitary, her main concern is still preventing child abuse. So this is really quite a remarkable lady. But we understand that she's been able to get some more letters out over the last few days. And she's talking about a court hearing of some description. Of course, she didn't attend court. This was conducted via video link from the prison. But there is some mention that she's expecting to be out. Now, I can't verify this information at the moment. We simply don't know. What we can say is that this lady has been locked up in prison for weeks, not knowing what charges are against her, or indeed whether she had been convicted of anything. But it seems that she may possibly be released. David, this is absolutely wicked that whistleblowers on child abuse are simply taken through a black system, a shadow judicial system, in order to put them in prison and keep them silent. John Major's comments against this background is particularly offensive. Thanks, Mike.
It is, but it's losing its credibility quite rapidly now. We used to speak to people maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and they simply wouldn't or couldn't believe what was going on. Or there must be more to it. You know, the authorities wouldn't do that. But case after case after case, the authorities are doing the most hideous things. And one by one, people are losing their confidence in them. We see that in the child abuse inquiries, where the various survivor groups have attempted to interact with the authorities. And one group by group, they've had to accept that the powers that be are simply not capable of providing any sort of justice. It's simply beyond their competence now. And that realisation is dawning on the people of this country, and I suspect on the people of the United States as well.
Okay. Well, and we're also mentioned the Doherty family here. We've still had no word from the Dohertys. Whether they're safe or not, we simply don't know. We're holding donations that people have very generously made for the Dohertys. We're simply holding those funds at the moment. But David, UK Column hasn't heard anything, and I believe that you haven't heard anything from them now for quite some time.
No, it's excuse me, 2 weeks now. And yes, it, with every day the concern grows that they are perhaps have insufficient shelter, insufficient food. And it's very galling because we had arranged the necessary support here in the UK, and we're just waiting to put that into effect. And we hope to hear from them, but it's very worrying indeed that we haven't.
Okay.
Okay, David, you wanted to highlight this. Nicola Sturgeon to deliver the Charles Kennedy Memorial Lecture. There's a level of hypocrisy in this, which in fact goes way beyond hypocrisy.
Yes, this is a few days ago. This lecture was given, and it was in Lochaber in Charles Kennedy's former constituency. Now, Nicola didn't tweet about it. I haven't actually managed to find the text of her talk. But the reason that it particularly annoyed me is that the SNP supporters, cyber Nats, local campaigners, hounded Charles Kennedy, vilified Charles Kennedy, who seems to have been a genuine and nice human being and a basically honest man. So they hounded him till virtually to his dying day, as the constituency went from Liberal Democrats to the SNP. The abuse was horrendous. I wonder whether Nicola Sturgeon has actually apologised about that as part of her talk. I don't know. I wonder who decided to invite her. It smacks of appeasement to me. I didn't like it. I would have thought that the people who wanted to honour Mr. Kennedy's name would have had more backbone.
Mm. Okay.
Okay, interesting. Well, change of subject here. We picked up on a report from a Turkish English-speaking newspaper, which has got a pretty black-and-white headline, US Commander Campbell, the man behind the failed coup in Turkey. And the article really piling in for the fact that something very, very dirty is going on. They're saying that General John F. Campbell, a former US commander of the International Security Assistance Force, NATO-led security mission in Afghanistan, was the organizer of the July the 15th military coup attempt in Turkey. And they say he managed soldiers behind the failed coup attempt. Of course, this wouldn't be NATO destabilizing nation state at all. And they say Campbell also managed more than $2 billion worth of money transactions via the UBA bank in Nigeria by using CIA links to distribute that money amongst the pro-coup military personnel in Turkey. So this is interesting stuff. But they're also mentioning this man as being in the background Fethullah Gulen. Now, this man has been resident in the United States for a very long time. He's been running a so-called education empire across the world. But many people in Turkey point a finger at him and say that this man has been working with the Americans in the background to destabilize the Turkish government. So we've just inset their part from his an image from his website. And, of course, this is all good. It's all for the good of mankind. It's all good for relations. And it's particularly good for young people who he's educating. Well, we followed this through a bit. This is a Nigerian newspaper, The Cable. They've also got the article. So it's saying that the Turkish newspaper has alleged that the United Bank of Africa played a key role in the distribution of funds for the facilitation of the failed coup. But a spokesman for the bank said the report is false and the bank would issue a statement on Tuesday to deny the allegations. Now, we weren't able to find that, but we've put up the bank's response, so that seems appropriate. But if we get into this subject, we quickly find the BBC, because the BBC is almost glowing in its support for the Gülen movement. If you'd like to go and have a look at this article, although it does mention some of the criticisms, the overall style of the article is pro the Gülen schools, and it ends on extremely pro note. This is just about education. There's nothing else to be seen. But they do put up a nice little map showing the influence of this organisation right the way across the world. But it's generally pro. And at this point, I'll bring in BBC Media Action, because we're fascinated that we couldn't find anything, any connections between Media Action and Turkey. Although, of course, Media Action boasted that it had been helping to destabilise President Assad in Syria. So these are some of the things that Media Action gets up to: reducing tension in Ukraine through youth-focused drama. Well, certainly BBC drama in UK is all about reducing tension or not. Tackling trafficking, human trafficking through drama. We don't use the police or law enforcement, but the BBC's charity is doing it through drama. And then they're strengthening Georgia's public broadcaster. So here we are, the BBC's charity, but no mention of Turkey. Except when you find the report that they've done with funding from the British government, Voices of Refugees, Information and Communication Needs of Refugees in Greece and Germany. I'll just bring in the research objectives of that. But they decided that the millions of refugees on the move, what did they really need? Well, they didn't need food and shelter and somewhere to rest.
And they need a soap opera.
Protection. What they need is a soap opera. Well, they don't actually say that, but the BBC's, well, they need better communications in order to solve their problems.
Right.
So Media Action, a charity, but it is, of course, the BBC, has been working with the British government to interview refugees to see how communications could improve their life. Odd thing is that if you search the Media Action website for Turkey, you get zero results.
They're trying to hide this report?
I don't know, Mike, but what I did find in the report, which is fascinating, is a map which clearly shows that the sort of start of the refugee problem, according to Media Action, is Turkey. But they don't bother to go into Turkey to talk to anybody in Turkey about the refugee problem. So BBC backs Gülen, but doesn't want to go into Turkey to find out what's happening with the refugees. I've got a suspicious mind, David, but there is something particularly dirty about the BBC's actions at the moment.
There is something very political about everything the BBC does. I mean, we know they've had secret meetings to establish a line over global warming. And the line is, be afraid. And if you don't agree, you're a denier and have to be no platformed. You have to be given no airspace. So there's only one line coming forward, the official propaganda line. And it would seem it's the same here on mass immigration into Europe. We're not getting too many other voices on that particular front. The slightly ridiculous aspects of the kind of North London metrosexual view of how to help people who are in serious trouble, I think this is just part of the whole BBC bag.
Indeed. Well, at that point,
Well, just before you do, I mean, I haven't looked at the two maps side by side.
Right.
But when you that's the first time I'd seen the Gülen map that you've just shown there.
Right.
I think people should just have a look at the Gülen map and the BBC Media Action map, because it's just from memory, it looks like they're operating in pretty similar parts of the country. The maps look quite similar from memory, so I can't say that for certain. I'd need to see them side by side, but maybe that people would like to do that.
Well, we'd encourage people to do it. Don't believe what we're saying. Do your own research and check it out. But let's bring in Robert Green. David, we mentioned Robert because he appears to be being threatened again by the Scottish Government. We showed this letter which he'd received and pointed out to our viewers and listeners that Robert had been faced with a civil court case between himself and Dame Eilish Angelini. But he was now receiving letters from the Crown Office, even though this Crown Office letter said, no, we can't get involved in civil cases. Can you tell us any more about this and what's happening at the moment with Robert?
Well, it's very difficult to know because there is a great reluctance, an enormous nervousness on the part of everyone involved with this to actually tell anybody, even Robert, what is actually going on. Here's what we know. This dates back, it would appear, to a private civil action that was taken out by Dame Elise Angelini immediately Robert got out of jail when he was jailed for breach of the peace. When he got out of the jail in Aberdeen, and she was suing him for defamation on the basis that he had made statements that she had been covering up what happened to Holly Gregg. Now, initially her lawsuit went very badly because Robert had legal aid and legal representation. So what then happened was the legal aid was removed. So you had the situation where Robert was defending himself against the former Lord Advocate and a host of high-priced, government-funded, we subsequently learned, lawyers, a completely unequal situation. Two Scottish judges wouldn't let that go forward because of the manifest unfairness. But it kept coming back until one judge, I think it was Lord Bannatyne, let the case proceed, and it duly found against Robert. Now, one of the things that Dame Elise Angelini wouldn't discuss is where all the money for this was coming from. Now, we now know it was our money. It was UK taxpayer money that was used to fund all of this legal effort against Robert Green. A legal effort, incidentally, that the Angelini team had offered Robert Green an end to this and no claims at all against him. And he said, well, yes, providing Dame Elise Angelini will join me in calling for justice for Holly Gregg, that will be fine. Something she would not do. So you can speculate why that might have been. But the case went on. And there was then a taxation, which was a taxation hearing for the expenses of the court case. Now, Robert questioned this because he had information that showed all of the costs had been paid by the UK Exchequer, that it had all been government funded. So he asked for proof that Dame Elise Angelini would ever have to pay this bill, there would ever be a loss. And he was told that there would be a response, and he gave the court some months to respond. And then eventually the thing timed out and there was no response. So essentially the matter was abandoned and that was Robert's position. Months passed and then the matter came up again. And then the Court of Session went ahead with the taxation hearing without Robert being present and apparently having lost all of the previous correspondence, so Robert was told, which was odd for an organisation like that. And thereafter, Robert once again defended his position that there had been no proof that there was ever a loss, and without proof he was unable to consider any form of payment under any circumstances. And a year went past, a year of silence, and then all of a sudden we have bailiffs coming. But it's got stranger still, because now it is no longer Dame Elise Angelini or Dame Elise Angelini's lawyers who are pursuing Robert. Now it's the Justice Directorate of the Scottish Government. Now, they should have nothing to do with private civil action, nothing. But that's the legal team that's doing it. And who is instructing them? The Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service, an organisation which, as you see from that previous letter, has nothing to do with civil action and only concerns itself with criminal prosecution. So we seem to be having a special exception being made for Robert Green, where the Scottish Government is going out of its way to cause him as much pain and discomfort, financial and otherwise, as possible. Now, why would they do that?
Well, we can only speculate on that, but let's bring in the next topic because maybe it helps. Here's the good old BBC saying that the Metropolitan Police sex abuse case has been, failings have put children at risk. So phenomenal investigative journalism by the BBC. They've quoted the report. The report saying in many cases, case after case after case, the police failed to take basic action to respond to complaints of child abuse. Perpetrators went free. The victims were let down. But really, there was a lot of it. But so what? Encourage people, though, to go to the BBC site, because at the end of this article, they ask you to get in contact with the BBC if you've got any information about child abuse. And you can put information in, and they say that somebody will come back and contact you. If you're happy to be contacted by a BBC journalist, please leave a telephone number that we can contact you on. And you've got the opportunity to put in some comments. So I should have in a minute some comments that I put in, but we'll bring that up in a slightly different context. So here you are, the BBC giving thousands of people the opportunity to hammer them over the fact that they are actually assisting the cover-up.
Now, David, in the meantime, the child abuse victims groups are continuing to boycott the main child abuse inquiry because, well, this article from the Telegraph suggesting that they're now experiencing demands that they have to sign up to a kind of code of conduct.
Yes, this would be very interesting to the detail of that, but it does seem bizarre, code of conduct. So we are putting pressure and limits on the survivors and victims. And there's still no, how many years are we into this inquiry now? There's still no justice. There's still been no public hearings. We haven't seen a single perpetrator actually brought to account. We haven't had a single explanation really of anything. And again, the confidence that people might have once had in the authorities ebbs away as they fail once again to deliver the most basic forms of justice. What are they for if they can't do this?
Indeed. And the other thing that you wanted to highlight on this same topic is something that Brian and the UK column have been talking about for so many years now, and that is the fraudulent activity of social services, particularly regarding children being taken into care, mostly unlawfully, from parents. This Belfast Telegraph article saying that a family court report was altered in a social services cover-up. This isn't the first time we've seen this type of behaviour, but it certainly seems like the first time we've seen it acknowledged in the mainstream press.
Yes, it was the Belfast Telegraph reporting on an English case, which I thought was quite interesting. Certainly, we know from the Doherty case that when it was revealed that Tuzla, the Irish child agency, who seized the Doherty children, did so without the mandatory preliminary assessment having been made. So their paperwork was completely absent. There was nothing there. So their actions had been unlawful. Well, they just went and created the report. It was entirely fictional, and they put it in the file, so the paperwork looks right. But it's fraudulent. It's they didn't actually repeat it. They didn't actually stand by that fraudulent report when they went to court, because that would be perjury, and you go to jail. But the report was completely invented. The whole interview with the children was completely invented. So we see this, and I know you have seen it many times as well, that the standard of the paperwork we're seeing from local authority, social services department, is just dreadful, and they play fast and loose with the truth. And the people who suffer are loving families, loving parents who lose their children. It's horrendous.
David, I'll just pick up on one of the points there. When you say they commit perjury and they go to jail, the problem is, of course, they don't go to jail. And I've had personal experience of being in a court where South Wales Social Services completely lied. They had fabricated a story around the case of a baby boy that was taken away from his parents. When I said to the judge, this is perjury, he said, no, Mr. Gerrish, I think it's a mistake. And this is how the criminal activity is allowed, because obviously the courts are part of the system, which is collaborating with condoning criminal action in order to take children and cover up their abuse. It cannot work unless the courts are part of it.
If you take, for example, Ian Puddock's story, where two policemen stood up and blatantly, transparently perjured themselves. Nothing happened. There was no charges. There was no court action. There was no legal action. It's dreadful. And it's if there is no rule of law, if the laws don't apply to everyone equally, then we no longer live under a country governed by the rule of law.
Absolutely. So we're just bringing that BBC opportunity to comment. This is what you can see if you go to the BBC article about the criticism of the police and CSA inquiries. So I decided I'd fill it in. So let's have a little look. I put in the comments. I receive considerable information about the abuse of children from survivors and the police. I have a recorded interview with a Met officer detailing the cover-up of child abuse by authorities in London, including the police, local authorities, child protection agencies and charities, and the bullying and harassment the officers suffered from the Met since trying to expose the facts. So I have a detailed interview with an abuse survivor and whistleblower who has been bullied, intimidated and harassed and imprisoned to silence her. There are thousands of cases with overwhelming evidence of the scale of abuse. So that was sent off, and the BBC was very kind because they sent me an automated thank you for your submission. So there we are on screen. We've given the BBC something to bite on. And as I've said at the top, what are the chances that the BBC will respond? And I think, Mike, they're zero.
Less than zero.
Less than zero.
Possible. Yes. Okay, let's change subjects again. This is from a few weeks ago, David, but we wanted to discuss the situation of the cashless society and the drive for the removal of cash. And of course, one perfect example of this is what was going on in India recently, and the fact that the government was withdrawing larger denominated notes from circulation, allegedly because of problems of tax evasion, but they weren't then providing small denomination notes to replace them with. And this was causing huge queues outside banks. And in fact, some people died in the crush as a result. Article here from the Times of Industry, the Times of India, saying demonetization, only 25% of daily cash demand being met. And I think you were making the point to me earlier that it's becoming increasingly possible with this attack on cash to sort of carry out any kind of transaction which isn't absolutely being assessed and viewed by government.
Yes. You will not be able to buy or sell lest you have the mark of the beast, I think comes to mind. In one regard, it's about control, and in another part, it's about the bankruptcy of governments. They're attacking here what they call the black economy, which is something that used to be called the economy. You know, people exchanging goods and services and helping one another and serving one another. Well, the government needs its cut. And cash is anonymous. We can't have that because we can't trace it, and you might not be entirely honest with the tax man, heaven forbid. So they need the money. They need the money desperately, and they're acting to get it by whatever means. But there's a bigger issue here where you have the entire monetary system is becoming bankrupt. The banks were bailed out, but the governments are now hitting the buffers. What's the next step? Well, the next step must be a variety of measures which are various forms of theft. And in order for the government and the banks to do this, they need to be able to pin down exactly what you have and where you have it and access that money and take that money at will, so that we can have things like negative interest rates. You can't have negative interest rates if people can simply withdraw their money, keep it in cash and not pay. So we are looking at systems being brought in that will simply make it easier for governments and banks to steal from the ordinary people, and that will be put forward as some sort of economic saviour economic plan to provide redemption. And of course, they'll do no such thing as theft and fraud is the problem. More of the same will not solve it.
Indeed. But as you say, all this government activity watching our day-to-day transactions, well, hidden from in plain sight, I suppose, was really got very little coverage over the last few days, is the fact that the Investigatory Powers Bill reached its final stage of Parliament. All that is left now before it becomes an act is royal assent, which is going to happen in the next few weeks. Well, this is, I thought, was just an interesting article in The Independent. It's Bill Binney, ex-NSA, technical director, saying that the new UK spying law is going to kill people. And what's he talking about here? Well, he's basically saying that allowing spies, as The Independent describes it, to look in on everything that everyone says costs lives and has cost lives in Britain because it inundates analysts with too much data. And I think this is possibly the silver lining on the cloud here, that somebody is actually admitting this. This is the point that Brian has been making for quite some time. Binney went on to say, it's 99% useless. Who wants to know everyone who has ever looked at Google or the BBC? We've known for decades that it swamps analysts. And he goes on to make the point that while they have some pretty impressive technology these days, that most people don't really understand that technology. They think it's ubiquitous, that it does everything for them. But in fact, the point that you've been making time and again is that eventually it has to end up with a human analyst. And my point here has always been that rather than trying to hide from the database, we should be, in fact, trying to swamp it, and particularly swamp it with wrong information. Perhaps we're getting a clue here as to the right approach to deal with this.
Well, I think it's absolutely true, Mike. A lot of people very wary, scared now of using a telephone or the email, and this is completely wrong. You should be talking to everybody that you want to. But if you care to add some complete nonsense into your emails, somebody somewhere is presumably going to have the job of assessing it. And what they are now telling us is that you can swamp the system out. So 10 million automated analysis hits at some stage has got to be grouped up and produced in a report to a human analyst. That's why they're recruiting, aren't they? So we're up to 5,000, an extra 5,000 people, I think it was, with GCHQ, because they can't cope with the dross increase in information.
Indeed. Just briefly, before we move on.
I wonder whether you might bring it back on screen, yeah, Mike, because I looked at the hairdo. Well, go on then, start with
the eyes. Well, it's just the eyes. I mean, she puts Tony Blair to shame, really. I mean, those are impressive eyes of evil.
Kind, aren't they?
Yes.
Kind eyes. I just looked at the hairdo, and it reminded me of the furry ear of my spaniel hanging down. And I thought, good grief. But
right.
There we are.
Well, look, on that note, we'll move on. But just before we do, there's The Independent also published an article today on this issue, which lists all the various agencies that now have access to our data. Everyone, as you would expect, from the Met Police, the City of London Police and various other police, the Royal Navy Police, Military Police, Air Force Police and so on, Ministry of Justice, National Crime Agency, and the Competition and Markets Authority can access your data and my data. I'm not quite sure why. Criminal Cases Review Commission, Financial Conduct Authority, that links to what we just discussed, the Food Standards Agency and the Food Standards Scotland, the Gambling Commission, Information Commissioner can access our data. That seems like a bit of hypocrisy there. Office of Communications, Office of the Police Ombudsman for Northern Ireland, Serious Fraud Office. So the list is pretty impressive. Do go and have a look for that. But we're just going to end on this one because the Bach Commission has reported. Now, this is a Fabian Society-sponsored investigation of the law and justice in England and Wales. The headline of the report is The Crisis in the Justice System in England and Wales. And what are they highlighting here? Several main points. Fewer people can access financial support for a legal case. Well, of course, that's intentional because the government has withdrawn much of the legal aid available. They say exceptional case funding has failed to deliver for those in need. They say that public legal education and legal advice is inadequate and disjointed. High court and tribunal fees are preventing people from pursuing legal claims. Bureaucracy in the legal aid agency is costly and time-consuming. And here we go, number six, possibly the most important one. Out-of-date technologies keep the justice system wedded to the past. Well, who was behind this? Lord Bach, as we say. Oh, sorry, I mislabeled that. He was at one point Justice Secretary, Permanent Secretary to the Department of Justice. He has said that when he was Lord Chancellor, he was talking about Michael Gove here, it looked for a moment as though Michael Gove had grasped the crisis in access to justice. He then went on to say, I hope that his replacement Liz Truss will be attuned to the importance of access to justice in a way that her predecessors, Chris Grayling and Kenneth Clark, were not. Now, the key point here is that he is sort of aligned with the views of Lord Leveson in his report from January 2015 on the review of efficiency in criminal proceedings. That was by Sir Brian Leveson, the Right Honourable Sir Brian Leveson. And really what he was highlighting here was the need to embrace new technologies for justice. So we want to get public away from the justice system as much as possible, bring in Skype and other similar technologies in order to push out justice to more and more people for less and less money. And of course, what they've done here is they've created problems within the justice system with a view to transformation into a form of justice that perhaps nobody on this programme would recognise.
Well, that's absolutely it, Mike. And we know from reports from courts across the country that there's chaos, increasing chaos, and people, of course, are being denied access. And we've just said that Melanie Shaw, we understand, had some form of video link from her prison cell or from her prison into a court. She doesn't appear in person. The public can't see her. It's all done by video link. David, this is we've got a fascist state coming in very, very quickly here. All of the pieces have been put in place, but they're now speeding it up.
We talked at the start of the programme about democracy and the fact that it's not the same as liberty. When it comes to protecting liberty, a far more important thing than the ability to go and put an X in a box once every 5 years is trial by jury. And that's under attack.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Okay, well, we'll just bring in, of course, Mr. Leveson involved in the look at the courts, the same Mr. Leveson who was working to help the government close down on free press and media. So you want some transformational change towards the dictatorship? It appears that Leveson's your man.
Yeah, indeed.
Okay, David, thank you very much for joining us. I'm going to say to our audience, we will give you as much information as we can about what's happening with Melanie Shaw and the Dohertys as soon as we have it. As I've said, we'll hold money that's been donated principally for the Dohertys, but we also have some money coming in for Melanie as well. We'll hold that until we've got firm knowledge as to what's happening. And for those of you who are perhaps new to the UK column, but if you're watching for free, perhaps you consider taking out a subscription or making a donation. The UK column needs your help on a daily basis to continue doing what we're doing. And at the end of the day, we would like to be expanding. We've got some ideas about what we'd like to do. And so as we take a look into the new year, I think UK Column is going to be asking for some considerable support from our viewers and listeners to get into a new league. I think that's right, Mike, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks very much for joining us. We will be back same time Monday. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.